No.
Nice. I'm at a database conference. So we have here. I'm bending over. It's kind of awkward.
More awkward.
More awkwardness. Fail. That's why I started a couple minutes early so that I could break everything first. So lightning talks, very, very exciting. We have a bunch of people who have come up with something that they can say in 5 minutes that will hold your attention the entire time. And we have Robert Haas here, who is going to be our timekeeper. And he has a few rules to lay out for everyone.
So basically, if you're one of the speakers, I'll give you a two-minute notice, one-minute notice, 30-second notice. When the buzzer goes off, it's time to stop talking. Don't wait until the buzzer goes off to think about stopping talking. When you see 30 seconds left, be done before the buzzer goes off, because otherwise the next person won't get their 5 minutes. Thanks.
He's going to be very strict and knock things over. Okay, so first up, we have... Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Peter is going to talk about PostgreSQL FS.
So PostgreSQL FS is a file system. So it's a hooks up fuse to Postgres or the other way around. I'm not really sure. So it works like SSHFS, except that it talks to Postgres database. And the reason why I actually started doing that was I just wanted to have a simple way to browse through a database that is a bit more graphical than PSQL and that was really and sort of more lightweight than pgAdmin. So my ideal was Midnight Commander, but trying to write a plugin for Midnight Commander, I didn't really figure that out. So I tried Fuse, it worked really well. It took me one day to write this and one day to clean it up. So the way this works is kind of like this. You have a binary there and you give it a mount point and D's for debug, which you don't really need to use, so it's a bunch of crap. And then you can you have data in your mount point. Those are databases there, a bunch of example databases from PG Foundry, if you need those. And you can use Midnight Commander, for example, to browse through your databases. And you can, let's see, you can go in this one. You have your schemas. And in the schemas, you have tables. And now it gets a little difficult because what do you do with the rows? And this is sort of where I had to make something up. So you have a if it has a primary key, which most of these example databases don't have, it actually puts the primary key there, but then to disambiguate that, you get this CTR key there. So that way you have guaranteed unique values. And you know, then you can, let's see, there's probably Canada somewhere down here. And then you have the columns here, so they're ordered there, so they have some reasonable order. And then you can sort of look into here and do fun things like that. So this is sort of as far as I go. I trying this out this morning. Actually, you can do fun things like crash your machine with this, which is or lock it up, which is kind of concerning for user space file system, right? So don't really rely on this too much yet. There are a few things I want to clean up. There's probably SQL injections somewhere in the code. it doesn't do writing yet, but that's just a matter of writing the right function. Which
you can't do initDB in here yet.
You can do initDB in here yet, no. And
that would be really cool.
And it's also very slow if you do something like a recursive grep. And this would really benefit from some kind of query cache, actually. So if you want to, you know, that's basically all of us. And that's actually all I wanted to achieve with this originally. So I put the code up this morning, actually, to the Git thing. So it's here, you know, on Postgres. Yeah, up there, you can see it. And try it out. It's easy to compile. I added an install file this morning, as you see there. So now you can actually try it out. So, yeah. Yeah, okay, I'm done. Thanks.
User error. Move this over here. trying not to knock things over. And then slideshow. You can just use the arrow key. Okay, wait, the arrow.
Oh, hey, my name is Regina Obey, and I'm on the PostGIS development group, the core development group, and also the steering committee that's not quite formed yet. In this talk, I'm going to talk about PostGIS, and I'm going to skip a couple of these slides. I guess we should start off with what...
what's wrong? Let's see. That isn't quite working, is it?
No.
Sorry, presentation fail. Now my machine's like frozen up. Look, I can click on things.
Are you running on PostgreSQL at best?
Try it this way. There we go.
Okay. So what is PostGIS? It's it provides OpenGIS spatial support to PostgreSQL. And it's been around since around 2001. It was developed by Refractions.
I'll skip that.
Who uses it? We're going to skip this too. This was something that I came up with by modifying. I think Greg actually showed this query. It's a recursive query. And if you show this in OpenGIS, you get a nice thing that you can actually zoom into. So now getting to the brunt of this lightning talk, there are a bunch of changes that have been going on in the PostGIS development. The first thing is the management changes. In the past, Refractions was in charge of everything involving PostGIS, but now we're beginning to develop a steering committee, and a lot of the brunt of the management has been moved to OSGO, and we're in the process of going through an incubation process. And so now our de facto project steering committee, which is not quite official yet, is composed of Jeff Lounsbury. He's the owner, and he's part of Refractions Research. Mark Cave Aylin from UK. Kevin Neufeld, who's also Refractions. Me from Boston, Mass. And Paul, who was one of the original developers of PostGIS, and he used to be president of Refractions before he decided to develop his geek side. PostGIS depends on a couple of complementary projects. There's the GEOS project, which is a port of Java Topology Suite, and the core developers in that right now are Paul Ramsey, Sandro, who's from Italy, and Mattis. And then there's also Proj 4, which is an OSGO. And there's a couple of complementary things. One is what's called WKT Raster, which in PostGIS 2.0 we hope to put into the core. And then there's PG Routing, which provides road routing. And then there's Tiger Geocoder, which Steve is going to talk about later. We just released PostGIS 1.3.6, which is the first version that can actually work with 8.4, and it also crashes a lot less when you give it curved geometries.
Somebody asked me a question about OGC 2.0 support, I think it was.
I don't think I have time for that.
Oh, okay.
And then 1.4, which is in Subversion, it hasn't been released, but people have been playing around with it. The main feature is that it's much faster. It does unions incredibly fast. It does intersects incredibly fast. So it's just fast. And it's got a couple more interesting functions for 3D and more beefed up curve support. And then I forgot to mention that we're writing a book, which is out, which my husband and I are writing a book, and it's expected to be out in hard copy January 2010. And there's the link to it. And then for 2.0, our goals are to introduce geodetic support so you don't have to do all that transform nonsense that you have to do when you have data in long lat. And then to integrate the WKT raster so you can do raster. Oh, Okay, I guess that's the end of that.
You have 30 seconds left.
Oh, I do? Okay. And then also 3D enhancements, ability to export to City GML, more export features, and hopefully we'll have 3D spatial indexes. So I think that's about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi. So let me see if I can just play it this time and not have it all fail. Work better? Yay!
So I'm going to talk about how we break things at Aster, and we like breaking Postgres. So we are four guys in Aster Labs right now, and when we use Postgres, actually, if you just do an LDD, you guys are using APIs. So you are depending on quite a number of libraries, and those things behave differently on different platforms, and they can break at different places. So if you look at simple things like even modify the descriptor table, if you look at the main page, I can return efold, eInval, or eNosys. If you are running Postgres on Ubuntu, you will get eNoMem. Okay? If you are using XML parsing, the same thing should return only 0, minus 1, and on Ubuntu you will get a 1. And on the different platforms you have, if you look at close, for example, if you do a little bit of networking, which might happen with Postgres, you will see that the error codes are different on the different platforms. Some things that are documented to never happen are actually happening, and there is a big mess out there. And so if you look at the recovery code or some parts that are relying on those error codes, you start to become much more suspicious on how those things are going to work and are going to behave. And so can we remove that thing at the bottom?
Yep, double-click on the background, do that. Just double-click on the other screen.
So I didn't do the slides, but there's this thing like, do you really trust Postgres recovery code? And on some platforms, I wouldn't bet that much on it. So those guys in Switzerland, so one of the co-founders of Aster is now an assistant professor in Switzerland, and they came up with that LFI thing, which is a fault injector that can inject faults at the library level and underneath at the kernel level. And so the idea is to inject faults that are very hard to produce in a test suite, things like returning error code at the library level, causing out-of-memory errors, causing network failures or real bad crashes, and see how Postgres is going to handle that or recover from that. And so you can put fault injection scenarios in an XML file, and you say, okay, at the 10th call of that function, you are going to return that value, and we are going to see what happened. And so you can have a bunch of fault injection scenarios and inject that in the system. So basically, the idea is you have this LFI controller here. I have to talk too close to the microphone. If you go to the website, 2 minutes.
Yeah, there's a laser pointer.
Oh. So the LFI controller here. So if you go on the website on SourceForge, the only example that is out there is actually with Postgres. So it's going to show you how to use that. And basically what it's going to do is going to look at all the API calls that you have in there, and it's going to just intercept them and replace the return value if you need to change a return value. And so the first time you run it, it can generate for you automated scenarios. It can look through the binaries and generate fault injection files that you can later edit if you don't want to do everything manually. There is a paper explaining how that thing works, and there is the website on SourceForge, so you can just note that you know. So the thing we are interested in, I'll try to put a wiki page on Postgres, but we'd like to know what are the things that really need to be stressed and tested in Postgres. What do you think is critical to be tested with that kind of tools? And so if you have interesting fault scenarios that we should start with, We are looking for your feedback, and because we are going to work on that anyway. And so talk to us either through the lists that are on LFI or through the hackers mailing list. I am on that list, and we'll try to put a wiki page together for your feedback.
I can post these slides on the wiki too as well.
Yeah, okay. Really thank you.
So this is...
Is that me? No, that's not
no,
me.
No, that's not you yet. Oh. This is Epic Test. Is Robert Brewer? There you are. Let's see if I can get the mouse over there.
You can go full screen. That'd be great.
Oh, that didn't work.
Full screen?
Can you go full screen with... Firefox? It's not...
Yeah,
F11? Sorry. F11. That didn't work. Oh, wait. Oh, function.
That is so close.
Sorry. I know. I am full of fail. Oh, my goodness. There's a menu called View.
It's between Edit and Go.
File. View.
You're in Finder now, though.
Click on Firefox. Click on View again. There you go.
Now do View.
And
you guys thought you were gonna zoom.
Window.
This is like window.
Tools.
The audience is full of tools.
That's okay.
We have to do the talk here.
All right.
I can do it minimized. It's fine.
All right. Sorry.
Check the cord. Okay.
Okay. There you go.
Okay. So as you saw, this is Epic, and it is more full of fail than any other testing framework, even in my presentations. Epic is available right now at epictest.org, so you can go check that out anytime you want. It is a very simple, very small, very safe, and a scoped and a schemaed test framework. So what do we mean by that? Well, simple is a couple things. It is entirely written in PLPGSQL. So if you are a guy who is so plugged into Postgres that you don't even want to think about Perl or Python, which happens to be my favorite language, but you want to stick with PLPGSQL, you can and write all your tests and run all your tests all from PLPGSQL. So it is small. There's only one file that you need to import into your database to write and run tests, and it is epic.sql. It is also small in the sense that there aren't very many functions. There is an assert function that you can assert any Boolean that you want. There's a set of equal, not equal, greater than, less than, and so on, and also an assert void function. And then there's a few that don't fit here that are like assert rows, and you can make sure that a result set has the rows that you expected, or you can assert that a result set had the columns that you wanted, or you can assert that it has certain values in certain cells of your result set. There's also an assert empty and an assert not empty for your result sets. So, and there's assert raises for exceptions. It's also safe. Every single test must raise exception at the end of the test, whether it passed or failed. And in fact, if you don't like writing in all caps, you can use the helper functions pass, fail, to do, and there's actually a skip off the screen there. So you can just finish your test by saying test.pass, and it will raise an exception for you. And if you don't raise an exception at the end of your test, then the test runner will complain very loudly at you and say, this is not a valid test. It's also scoped. And what I mean by that is it's modular in the sense that any function, you basically write new functions to write tests in Epic. And every function, you can tag it and say, well, this is in the test users module or the orders module or the invoices module. And so when you run your test, you can either run a single test, you can run all tests in a module, or you can run all tests in your schema. So there's an example of that. Doesn't quite fit. But in your create function, you just do dash dash module and name it. Finally, it is schemaed. Everything is in the test schema. Yes, sir?
What happens if you have a test schema
already? You have the option of changing that, if you like. Yep. And the reason it's nice to have it schemaed is when you go to production, you don't want that propagating to your production DB. So you can just drop schema test and get rid of all that. It is also, finally, one I didn't list. It is sweet. There's a couple cool things about it. One is that when you design something like this, you have to make a lot of trade-offs. One of the trade-offs I made is that a lot of the assert functions take a call argument. And so what you end up doing is writing a lot of your actual SQL in a string. A lot of people hate that, but it made everything so much easier to, if you want to do some different things with the same general bit of logic, I can have the test framework rewrite it for you, and you don't have to rewrite it every time. So, for example, one thing that enables is there is a global function, and what the global function does is it takes whatever SQL string you pass to it, select statement, and it grabs the result of that, and it puts it in a temporary table for you. So we're in effect mimicking the use of global variables. So if you have a test, and that test calls other functions, and you want to be able to pass data in between them, you use temp tables behind the scenes, and that's enabled by using the call string. In fact, when you use a call string, you don't even have to include the select star from if it's just a table that you want to pull the whole thing from. So calls are great. Once you do the global command, then what you get returned to you is the name of that temporary table. And once we have that, then all these other great functions work, like get. So there's a get function, test.get, and you pass it the name of your table and what you want to get out of it, and you get a row back. Or you can look at the name of the temp table that you got back. It's available in a private variable, so you can pass it around. You can also call the getter function, and that's going to return some SQL that you can execute then to get some rows. There's a constructor function to get the actual SQL that you passed to make the temp table. You can get the length. You can get all the columns in the table, so on and so forth. So Epic is there. It is more full fail than any other framework. EpicTest.org. Thanks.
Okay, and now let's see if I can unfail this. Oh, will that fix all of my problems? Okay. Okay. Should I try it? Ooh, look, my sound is now doing something here. Okay, so someone says that if I go into here.
Now to scroll down in the list there.
Scrolling. Oh, which one should I pick?
60.
Yeah. Do it. No do-overs in Lightning Talks. Okay. It's too bad. Sorry about that. Do I have anything scandalous up here? No.
Oh, God.
Quit. Okay. That was more than my allotted time. Sorry.
And, how do I go to the next page?
You can use the clicker. And if I do, yay.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to talk a little bit about page cuts and the buffer cache and some things that we might be able to do to improve that situation over where we are now. Right now, Postgres basically plans your query with the default settings as if your entire database is not on disk. It uses these two parameters, random page cost and sec page cost, to estimate the cost of reading in your data, and those values are set assuming that all of your data is going to be on the disk. Now, there are a couple of minor exceptions to this. They're pretty minor. Effective cache size accounts for the possibility that the same index scan might hit the same page more than once, and then, of course, it probably wouldn't have to read it in the second time, but it does nothing for the fact that two index scans that are done one right after another might also hit the same page. We also disregard the cost of accessing non-leaf B-tree index pages. That, again, is a very small effect. There may be some other minor exceptions, but these are the only ones I know about. So the question becomes, what should you do if your whole database isn't on disk? Well, if everything is in memory, you can kind of get around the problem by just reducing sec page cost and random page cost. The default values are 4 and 1, and if you reduce them to maybe 0.1 or 0.05, then you'll get pretty reasonable plans. in at least in my experience, maybe other people have other numbers that works for them. Another thing I've heard advocated, including on the mailing list, is raising the CPU cost parameters. That basically works out to the same thing, but in my opinion, it's a more confusing way of getting at the effect that we're really trying to get at here. Now, of course, the obvious question that comes up here is what happens if you don't have a situation where basically everything is on disk, and you also don't have a situation where basically everything is in memory. Well, to make a long story short, your host, because you don't really have a way of modeling that. So what you're probably going to do is you're probably going to go fool around and come up with some blended value for random page cost and sec page cost that seems to produce good plans, and you'll hear a lot of these values being thrown around on the mailing lists from time to time. I've heard 2 and 1, or I heard somebody told me 0.5 and 0.3 yesterday, and there's probably others. But this is really oversimplified because of the fact that you don't, it's not really the case that 0.5 can never be the right value for all of your pages. It can be too low for some and too high for others, but it can never really be right for everything. So maybe you'll work out all right. So what could we do about this? Well, having given this problem a little bit of thought, but not enough to actually write any code or do anything useful, I came up with a two-part sketch of a solution. The first part would be use some kind of statistics to estimate what portion of the table is likely to be in memory, and then the second part would be modify the formulas that use the page cost to take into account the chances of hitting a cached page, which is not entirely straightforward, but there's not a lot of places, and there's probably only a few different ways that it would be intelligent to thinking about doing that. I think the really hard part is probably the first one, how to estimate what portion of the table is likely to be in memory. We had a little, four of us sat down at PostgreSQL East and thought of different ways to do this, and we came up with about 10 of them, and they all had obvious flaws that were pointed out by the people who weren't advocating any particular solution. That's about as far as I got. Thanks.
And that was Robert Haas. I hope you all... Did you all know that? I don't know. Did it say it? Okay, good.
No, where did you...
Okay, so now I find my mouse. And then it was... What is it? Shift... Command-Shift-F?
Yeah. Let's shut down.
You're watching me learn things. Okay.
All right. Hi, Jonah Harris from mybrick.com. Just wanted to go through some of the tools that we've been using and developing lately. Some of them might help you, some of them might not, but just want to let you know that they're out there. So we have a couple tools here that I'm going to go through. I won't need the 5 minutes, but let's go. So Bloat Report, if you know Michael and I and Gavin haven't given you the hint that we have significant bloat problems on the order of 50-plus gigabytes per week on some tables, we have a bloat report, which Michael actually went over in his talk. And it's good for identifying which tables and which tables are good candidates for either more frequent vacuuming or to be cleaned up. You'll notice on each of these slides that we're an equal opportunity programming language house. So this is written in Ruby. And this is actually, as it says, it can be used against a whole variety of servers. We run it across all the servers in our data center right now at once. Concurrent reindex is the tool that we use after we identify the tables that we need to reindex. This is a command line PHP program. And basically what it does is it looks at, you point at it, either one index or a table, and it'll do a create index concurrently, drop and rename for you. So it's really nice. It'll clean up after itself if you hit a deadlock, that sort of a thing.
Does that look at the primary key
index? You can't reindex primary keys. So we don't actually use primary keys. We use unique indexes. So that's that one. Galconda. Okay, say it, Gavin.
Galconda.
Galconda. Okay. It's changed a couple times. So, anyway, if you're in Gavin's talk just a little bit ago, it's a loosely coupled data distribution system. Can be used for replication, but it can also be used to distribute any type of data to different types of nodes over the network. It's queue-based. Limiter is a program that I just wrote a little bit ago because we're doing something cool that parses log files real-time, and you need to limit that on a production system. So what Limiter does is basically let you set a percentage of CPU that you want to you will only give it to run, and what it will do is limit any program to that. It's Linux-specific, so. Player is one talked about at PG East. A few people have used it. Basically, it's designed to do application testing, either from a performance standpoint or from a functionality standpoint. So if there's a Postgres upgrade, you want to run your exact same production workload against it and see what breaks. Player is good for that. Basically, it reads the Postgres log file, builds a binary set of files, and replays that exact same workload. Posta, which is what Michael talked about, is a stat system that we've been working on. Basically, it's designed to persist Postgres statistics and let you query them over time to look for trending and or to, you know, find a problem at, you know, when you have a problem at 3 o'clock in the morning and you don't want to be up, you can always go back and look at the stats from that point in time.
How do you say that one?
Posta.
The U is silent.
Yes. Michael will give you the history if you, you know. And yes, it does have Lisp. Primer is one utility that we wrote because we use a lot of WORM standby. The problem is that when you have, you know, 180 gigabyte database and 128 gigs of RAM, and you want to switch over to another server, you, at least in our case, have about an hour to an hour and a half's worth of cache warming, and things don't perform very well during that time. So what this does is it profiles the cache, both the Postgres buffer cache and the Linux page cache, to see what Postgres objects are in there. It will store that profile, and then what you can do is move that profile over to the server you're going to bring up, have it bring that those blocks specifically back into cache, and we don't have, you know, it's like a one-minute cache warming.
Isn't that solved Robert's problem partially?
No. Somewhat. Problem, but it's interesting. So... download of most of those tools, with the exception of Golconda, are on Area 51, and Golconda is on the Google code. So.
And Posta, where is that?
Posta will be on Area 51.
Hi, I'm Jasper Peterson from JBoss, which is a division of Red Hat. So I'm going to present monitoring Postgres from the JBoss application server. So the main problem is that we want to monitor a JBoss application server installation, which being an entire cluster, and related systems that are hooked up to that cluster, sort of like examples like Postgres. Basically, we have three products. We got a product called RHQ, which it provides the basic functionality for monitoring various systems. And then we have a product called Dropper, which monitors entire systems, where a system can be defined from the CPU itself to file systems, various tools that you may run on your service like SHD, and then entire databases like Postgres. And the top level application is called Embedded Java, which is an administrator UI. So in the next couple of slides, we're going to focus on the middle part, where it's actually monitoring Postgres. So this is a setup, the default summary page for the Postgres monitoring plugin, and which provides basic functionality about virtual memory, physical memory, and various statistics that you find that are needed. And then it provides an overview of alerts that you have set up in the alert column, where you basically can enable triggers to fire on different events like memory usage, CPU usage, transaction per seconds, transaction aborted, and all those parameters that the plugin provides. And then there's the actual monitoring page where you actually can see graphs of different things. So here we have, let's see, this is transactions committed per minute and the transaction rollback and the size of the database and the number of backends that are actually active, so the number of connections. These are the sites that you could go to and get the source codes for. It's all the things are available as open source, and it doesn't necessarily have to run on JBoss. It can run on any Java-based system. Thank you.
And next we have...
Oh.
That's the only slide.
Let's start at the beginning. Okay.
Which one? Okay. Hi, Robert Lohr. I work at Sun, soon to be called Soracle. Anyway, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the state of D-trace probes in NA.4. So D-trace probes got into 8.2 a few years back, and we started with 11 probes. And they were pretty low-level probes, you know, that can collect lock contentions, transactions, processing, and stuff like that. And then, 8.3, we still had 11 of them. Well, I was on vacation the whole time. Yeah. And 8.4, of course, we got more people interested. Folks from OmniTI, you know, Theo's and Robert Treat is, you know, showing interest in this kind of stuff. They make contribution to some of the probes, and I work on some of them, and we ended up having 54 of them. So there's, you know, some interesting probes right now that you know, I think will be of interest to quite a few of you. The time spent in query processing, you know, you can find out how long it takes to process the whole query, or just for parsing, rewriting, planning, transaction processing. You can find out the transaction, you know, commit, abort, and whatnot. You know, buffer usage. You can find out, you know, buffer write and read and hit and misses, and you know, all kinds of stuff. Checkpoint. You know, time spent for sort. You know, whether a sort is external or internal, and you'll see an example later. And of course, the low-level probe sumar lock contention. You know, some of these data you can actually get from the log files. But you know, the cool thing about D-trace is, you know, you could just turn on the probes whenever you need to look for data, and then, you know, turn them back off. So, which operating system can you use this probe on? So right now, the probe's been tested on OpenSolaris, Solaris, and then Mac OS. And the future FreeBSD, my understanding is that the user space, the user land implementation is not quite there yet, but it's coming. For Linux, I think Tom has done some work to compile it so that the probes can be used with SystemTab. And there's an effort going on by one guy to port D-trace to Linux in the user space. I don't know what the status of that is. Anyway, so to use the probes, you'd have to write, you know, some D-trace scripts to really enable the probes. And so I've put together a toolkit that you can find on the PGTran Foundry website. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of D-trace script that you can use along with the tool, actually. So... for those of you who might have seen D-trace script and you look at it, it's like, you know, what is this? You know, it's actually a new scripting language in D. So it's actually, once you get used to it, it's actually pretty straightforward. So if you don't like to deal with dtrace scripts, like I said, there's a tool that comes with this toolkit that's available on Fiji Foundry. So I'll integrate a few scripts into this tool. So on the left-hand side, it's called a display. Pretty much you just, you know, pick what you want to see, you know, click on run. You know, you get something like this. So I'll plan on integrating some more of the dtrace scripts in this tool. Anyway, so what else can you ask for, right? I mean, you get cool probes, you get a GUI tool that you have to learn a new script. So, demo. So the demo will probably take 15 minutes. Is that okay? Anyways, when you talk about dtrace, you really cannot skip a demo, right? But instead of a live demo, I'll just you know, show a screenshot from a live demo. So anyways, identifying slow query, I have a script to do that. So this query takes, you know, a few seconds. So I want to drill down some more. I want to find out, so I run the query in PSQL, and then I have a dtrace script running. So it tells me that the how long it took to run the query, and whether the query, so because it's ordered by the external sort, so and I found the time. So anyways, I know that it's external. I want to have it done in memory, increase the work mem, rerun the query, rerun the script, found out it's an internal sort, so look at the time, it's about half the time. Second one, again, identify the slow query, run the script, drill down.
Time's up.
If you look at the time.
Time's up.
Anyway, so it's all in there.
I'm going to post the slides so you can get all those links.
Thank you.
Okay.
That would be the last slide.
Oops.
Which is not even going to happen anyway. I'm surprised you didn't take it out. I expected you to. There you go. Presentation. And what do I click?
Forward.
Excellent. All right. Tiger 2008 Geocoder. I do. I work for Noblis, blah, blah, blah. Stephen Frost, if you don't know me. So the Tiger 2008 Geocoder, I'm working with a guy named Daryl. He's really been pretty helpful. One of the big things that he did that helped a lot was updating the scripts for the 2008 shapefiles and making sure that the really badly written scripts that I had first written worked with 2008. He also went through and... Sorry, let me take half a step back real quick. Tiger is the census data available from the U.S. Census that contains road-level information, including block-level address information for every street in the country. Okay? So your street's probably in here if you live in the U.S. It's really useful. It was imported into OpenStreetMap. There was some discussion about that in another talk, which is really wonderful, and we all love it. It's excellent. It's gotten a lot better, too, with the 2008 release, because they went through an improvement project, so it's good stuff. So, anyhow, the scripts for loading this data, which it ends up loaded on disk with indexes around 40 or 50 gigs, so this is not small. I mean, it's not huge, but it's pretty substantial. It's about 20 gigs to download it all compressed in compressed files. Went off of their website. If you have any problems, I can get you a Postgres export if you want. Anyhow, the options for inheritance versus views. So this is something that surprised me a little bit, is apparently there's a difference in terms of performance, and the inheritance works better for partitioning than the views do. According to Darrow, anyway, so he built out some scripts that did that allowed for both. Since re-implemented those scripts in Perl. So now we have a Perl dependency for the Tiger Geocoder, but I hope that's not a big deal. It's just for loading the data. If you want to, I can give you a PG dump and you can go off with that. We also have a number of operations like automatically creating indexes on all the appropriate tables for this data. Lots of different indexes, honestly. The GIST ones are, of course, always the most expensive, and no, I haven't written in parallelizing them yet. I want to. The lookup tables for the 2008 data have changed quite a bit, mostly because we actually looked at the documentation that they provide, which we hadn't really done before. We kind of just were like, well, we think drive is D-R-I-V-E and D-R, and that's all we're going to look at. And sure, that is generally correct, but they actually provided documentation with 2008, and it's quite decent, and so we use it for all of that. We also have some tables that we build based off of the information that's provided from Tiger, such as the zip data. So one of the big questions that always comes up in geocoding is, you know, I have this zip code. Where do I go to look for things that are associated with it? Particularly when you're using partitioning and you want it to be fast and you want to, you know, we partition it by state. So we take the zip code and we look, you know, we build a table that's like every zip code that shows up in any associated with any street for this state. It's useful. One of the things that's on the to-do list is getting rid of the now unused lookup tables that had the random garbage. So one of the other big things that happened recently with the Tiger 2008 work is that I rewrote the normalizer. So basically, I hadn't touched it since the original implementation of it, which was done by someone at PostGIS, and I don't remember who, and that's really sad, although most of it's been rewritten now. Anyhow, so Daryl first rewrote it, and he used regex a split to array, which admittedly is only available in 8.3, so now we have an 8.3 dependency. Daryl's PLPGSQL it was cool that he used regex split to array. I went through and changed it all quite a bit after that, and so it's basically been rewritten again, but it works pretty well. I also rewrote a lot of the geocoder stuff, and it's all now using execute, and I'm really looking forward to return execute, and I hope that someday we'll have that able to be a performance increase such that we can actually stream things back instead of having to build it. There are the Git home sites for if you want to put. I've got something up on mine, and then the GitHub one is Daryl's. So he's got some stuff that I haven't included yet. And I've...
You're doing Daryl?
Really?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, I had no idea. That's so funny.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
What the fuck later?
Hey. Click. Oh, did I go to the wrong slide again? Let's see. Okay. Let's see here. There we go. Beginning. And then if I. Oh, hey. That's a little bit. That's a little small, I mean. There we go. Ah!
Hello, I'm Dimitri, and I'm going to talk about PGQ, and it's going to be pretty darn quick. So this talk is about having reliable batches. So we will see what I need when I say this. We will see what PGQ offers to answer the needs and how to mix and match the needs and the solution. Often when you're doing a non-LTP system, which is, for example, a web application, you have a lot of things you want to do, but not at the time the user is interacting. So you commit, and afterwards you do things. So you want asynchronous processing. And in the web service world, a lot of things are done in PHP, so you want to reuse the existing models, extra, a lot of code. And the daemon stands to look like this, and does not make a real Unix daemon. So what you have is that, and what you want is easy to monitor and control and reliable daemons. And you prefer them when they run out of developer session, you know. And it's better if it's easy to stop and restart like the usual services stuff in the system. But as you want to reuse model, for example, you're stuck with PHP, Python, or whatever. Now PGQ. PGQ is a queuing solution, so you put in there events, and then you process them. The providing of events is transactional. It's done at commit time in PostgreSQL. And consuming is what you have to write. So that's the main characteristic of PGQ. So I prefer to show you that before, rather than have you assume them, but it's 5 minute talk. And PGQ comes in a SkyTools package. So it's the SkyTools is made in Python, and you have all the infrastructure to make your own scripts in Python. And there is a PHP library too. But what's good about it is that all the hard stuff is done into the in PLSQL, SQL, or C code. So you just have to call the SQL level API. So what you do, for example, with the PHP stuff, it's that you subclass the class you're given, and you have two methods to implement. The first one, config, is optional, and it allows you to set up some things. And the second one, process event, the processing you have to associate for each event you've been producing. At the end of this function, what you do is returning one of those values, which will have an impact on what happens next. PGQ comes with a failed event management and a retry event management. So you can just mark the event as a retry later. I had a temporary failure. And the event goes back into the queues, and you will get it. Depending on exactly what you're doing with PGQ, you're bound to use one of these classes. The first is if your processing happens on the same database than the consuming. And the second and third one are to use if the processing happens on a remote database. The classic example of the remote database processing is a replication, for example. Long list is based on PGQ and use those concepts, but in Python rather than the PHP stuff I'm talking about. So once you have the PGQ PHP library, what you do is port your existing stuff into them. Basically, your all the processing you've done, you put it into the process event function, and you're done. And at the end of the day, you get start, stop, status, extra classic interface to control the diamonds. And you even have a nice minion monitoring. And for example, what happened here is that we discovered a bug in the processing, so we stopped the daemon, fixed the bug, and launched the daemon again. And so the monitoring saw that the last time that the processing happened, so last scene, and the lag, so it was providing events that were not consumed, so they augmented drastically, but we relaunched the bug-free daemon, and all is good again. Okay.
All right. And now we have Josh.
Yay. What Josh, number is this?
Josh, number one. This is number 11. There's only one left after this.
All right.
Oh, come on.
Oh, no, that's not good.
Let's make it bigger.
That's much nicer.
Okay.
Okay, what bigger? Do I push? Better, yeah. Forward. This laser.
Yep.
I don't think I need one, but okay, good. My name is Josh Colley, sometimes known as Eggy Nap. I'm going to talk about how not to review a patch based on my experience poorly reviewing a patch. What's patch review? Patch review is to test new features, maintain consistent code. You heard some of this if you were in Tom and Bruce's How Not to Get Your Patch Accepted talk. And to advance the project. So it sounds neat. Can I help? The answer is no. It takes too much time. Most Postgres contributors are independently wealthy and work on Postgres all day. These people know more than you ever will, and you are not welcome. You have to understand all the code, or at least some of it. Only C experts will be admitted. No one wants your help. Postgres people have never heard of you before. They do not like newcomers. They are really mean. You may not help.
So what if I've already started helping? If you have made the mistake of starting helping, this is for you. You volunteered. Your name is on the wiki somewhere. There's a patch review page in the commit fest, and it says, here are all the patches somebody wants, and you've been stupid and you've put your name next to it to say, I'm going to help. This was my problem. Your name is on the wiki. You've answered an email on hackers, and now people are sending stuff to you. Disappear. This is a really good tactic. Berkus loves it when you do this. Am I right? This is how to be on Josh's Christmas card list. Even better, tell hackers I got it to compile and then disappear. Or just quit worrying about it. If you can't review the code, your input isn't valued anyway. If you don't know C well enough to make some sense of this and tell us where it's wrong, we don't want you. Everything you have just been told is false. And I'm glad I made it. I have 40 slides in 5 minutes. I'm glad I made it this far, because everything you've just been told is wrong. Postgres wants your help, even if you're not a programmer, even if you've never contributed before, and even if you're not sure what you're doing. Nobody else is either. Here's what you do. Read the hacker's mailing list. Find a patch. Apply it. Test anything you can possibly think of, even if you think it's stupid. And then publish your results and pay attention for Josh to email you again and answer questions. My favorite thing to do was to publish some results saying, I think this works, and then not answer questions about it on the patch for about 6 months. You were on this thread too, you remember?
Yeah,
I was good at that. Answer questions, rinse and repeat, because this will go on for a long time. You'll find that it's addicting. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Right, so my name is Josh Berkus. I will send you email. And I'm here to talk about evil. Now, there's a lot of evil in the world, and some evils are subtle and pernicious. I'm here to talk about a subtle, pernicious evil that gets into your home and your workplace and ruins your life and makes you stay up weekends at work and ruins your marriage and is just more horrible than anything you see here. Of course, I'm talking about surrogate key abuse. Now, a lot of people don't understand this problem, so I wanted to give you a few definitions. I'm here, by the way, from the Society to Stop Surrogate Key Abuse, or SCK, as we call it, where we've dedicated ourselves to stamping out this evil worldwide. So let me give you a few definitions. Now, a key is a unique predicate which identifies a tuple. It gives you, it's the minimum amount of information that you need to decide that this tuple is a unique data entity. So an example of that would be if you had a database of, say, conference room reservations, where people had the rooms all day, then your unique predicate would be the room number and the date. And nobody else can have that room number and that date at the same time. So that is your key. Now, a surrogate key is an arbitrary unique ID value, usually a number, that's been attached to a tuple, which is completely unrelated to tuple contents. It's sort of a handle or a tag or a barcode that really tells you nothing about it. So here's an example of that. So we've got our surrogate key, which is this auto-generated ID number, our serial. And this serial, this number 44906, actually tells us nothing about room 204 or the date of 2009-04-17. Now, surrogate key abuse is misuse of those surrogate keys in a way which harms your data and makes it cry. Oh, and by the way, you ask what's about a primary key. A primary key is a meaningless implementation detail that got into the SQL 92 standard, mostly for backwards compatibility with older databases. But there is no difference between a key and a primary key. So a lot of people say, well, why is surrogate key abuse so evil? So I'm going to tell you a little story When I'm not doing database stuff, one of the things that I do is pottery, and I make my own glazes. And creating new glazes and pottery is a test-intensive process that involves doing hundreds and hundreds of test tiles. Now, in order to keep track of all these little test tiles, I tried putting little numbers on the back. And then when I get them out of the kiln, of course, they become all jumbled up, and there's and I rely on those numbers and the notes that I took with all of the numbers to figure out which test tile is which. But one day, I left the notes too close to the kiln. At which point, I pretty much had to throw out all of those tiles. This is surrogate key abuse. Don't let it happen to you. Now, our primary forms of surrogate key abuse are no real key. When you just attach a surrogate key to a tuple and you never identify a real key for that tuple. That's the most common one. A second one is the creation of unnecessary surrogate keys. When you were using the real key anyway, why add a surrogate key? The third one, which often happens to the application layer, is because one int 4 looks exactly like another, swapping keys between two tuples, which is very common when you practice the fourth and most awful form of abuse known as object IDs, or UUIDs, where you have, in fact, eliminated any distinction between tables or views of different types at all, and everything has the same ID. These are the standard excuses for practicing surrogate key abuse. None of these are good excuses. They are all based on misunderstanding or lack of knowledge. And, of course, the primary excuse, performance, which is based on premature optimization and generally harms actual performance. Avoid surrogate key abuse. Make sure all your relations have real keys. Use natural keys where you can. Avoid premature optimization. It must be stopped. If you really loved your data, you wouldn't abuse your keys. Thanks.
All right, could all the speakers that are in the room still, could you stand up? We had a couple people who went early because they had to go to the airport. So stand up, speakers. I'll give you a round of applause. Thank you so much. All right. And now I think I'm going to turn this over to Dan. Thank you, everybody. Yeah, lightning talk speakers. Oh, no, no. No, then it was great. It was like a huge love-in at that point.
Too many cables. Oh, my God.
I know. This is dangerous.
Yep. You better hide it away, Joe.